This is Betty Smith, February 24th and 25th, 1990, Aphrodite, tape 5 of 6.
That's here in the work, and we're going to do some other, as the afternoon goes, we're going to take this myth into its next step, which, as you know, is the making. Hephaestus makes a net. I want you already to be chewing on the image, if you will. He makes a net, a very fine bronze mesh, elegant, but so fine as to be almost invisible. And he lays it, hangs it over the marriage bed in such a way that when Aphrodite and Ares come to the bed, the net comes down over them. So the next scene will treat the net scene. And I'd like you to be thinking about what's there in the net. What does it mean to capture? We'll be looking at it just from the standpoint of the myth, but also what it... it's pretty important that Hephaestus makes this net and gets the two of them. And he sees the whole thing. He sees... perceives the love, perceives the relationship and what's going on, and then he has to come to terms with it. But to catch the opposites, to have a net, to have a kind of container in one's own process that can capture the opposites in experience and in some way that's a way to bring them into life. A way to perceive them and to hold them or something is also important. So there are ramifications of the net that should be very interesting to us. Okay. And I know I've generalized, I've not really clarified where Eros is... action leads off and Aphrodite's begin, because I don't know how to do that. Eros is a seemed to come as the more the initiative of the love process, the initiative of falling in love, the initiative of taking love, of going with it, and the suddenness of the love experience. And Aphrodite would be more the broad sustaining base of love and its process in the earth and its many phases, the seed, the bloom, the fruit. But I don't know specifically how... I know that in very anciently, in the Archaic Age, in the Homeric Age, you didn't even see Eros with Aphrodite. Aphrodite was given credit for all the lovings. Then later, Eros develops as a separate character, figure with her. And it's only in the Psyche myth, in late antiquity, almost to the Christian era, that beginning of the Christian era, that you have Aphrodite as a negative mother with Eros, her son, and she is the taskmistress goddess. So we do want to just touch on one little part of the Psyche myth this afternoon in the end. But I think it does help the Psyche myth a great deal to see Aphrodite as taskmistress. The taskmistress is always dark to us. We don't like the boss. We don't like anybody that tells us you got to do this or else. We put a gorgon on that person oftentimes. So she is a taskmistress to Psyche, and she brings Psyche through quite a process. And I think it's someday I'd love to do just Psyche with you. All right, it's time, and we come back at 1:30. All right. We begin now. From the second hymn to Aphrodite, the Homeric hymn, just like to remind you of some of the images that have classically attached to Aphrodite ever since the Homeric age, which goes back to 8th or 9th century BC. This is the second hymn. It's the short one to Aphrodite. The other hymn to Aphrodite, Homeric hymn, has the story of the love of Anchises. And Aeneas came out of that love. Of august gold-wreathed and beautiful Aphrodite I shall sing, to whose domain belong the battlements of all sea-washed Cyprus, where blown by the moist breath of Zephyrus, she was carried over the waves of the resounding sea in soft foam. The gold-filleted Houri, the Hours, happily welcomed her and clothed her with heavenly raiment. Then on her divine head they placed a well-wrought crown, beautiful and golden, and in her pierced ears flowers of brass and precious gold. Around her tender neck and silver white breast, they decked her with golden necklaces, such as the gold-filleted Houri themselves are adorned with whenever they go to lovely dances of the gods and to their father's house. And after they decked her body with every sort of jewel, they brought her to the immortals who saw and welcomed her, giving her their hands, and each one wished that he might take her home as his wedded wife. For they marveled at the looks of violet-crowned Kithaeria. Hail, honey-sweet goddess with the fluttering eyelids. Grant me victory in this contest and arrange my song, and I shall remember you, and another song, too. Undoubtedly, it was a poetry contest, or a festival, where the poets were holding forth. So that's the moment of her adorning and taking on the many aspects of the feminine that have to do that in the greater feminine have to do with context, atmosphere, a density of ambience that is very, very feminine, that is feminine, and is more the power of the feminine than any act or word is. The power of the feminine is more in its circle, the circle. We sometimes see that circle as dancing in the nymphs with Persephone on the seashore with the sea nymphs, or Artemis and her maidens at a spring. We feel the circle of the maidens and the dance and the power of that joyousness. If with Aphrodite, you feel it very much with surrounded by the graces and the hours. And there is a blessing in these attendants. They are goddesses of blessing, the hours. Goddesses of fruits and flowers and blessing. Blessing on human undertakings. Especially the graces have the blessing on the human undertaking, but it comes from presence. It doesn't come from some ritual that's pronounced, and she holds her hand up and says, I give you this. It is in her presence. So this is why it's difficult to talk about Aphrodite. It's why it's difficult to, you'll never be able to reduce her to concepts or clear definitions, because the sense of presence is a very difficult thing to describe, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It really has to be experienced. Among the existential philosophers of this century, or philosophers of being, actually he doesn't call himself an existentialist, is Gabriel Marcel, the French playwright and philosopher of being. He does a very fine analysis, isn't the word, but he does a very fine description of presence, the meaning of presence, in his work, The Mystery of Being, two-volume work, The Mystery of Being, that has spoken a great deal to me. And I think there's something essentially a feminine aspect of being itself that he's describing, open to man or woman, but a feminine aspect of being itself is in presence. But Aphrodite particularly had this. Sometimes Hera, in her best moments, Aphrodite moments, was thought to be with the Graces also. And they are sculpted on her throne at in one of her ritual thrones at Argos in ancient times. All right, I just wanted you to hear those... Anything you want to say right now about the myth of the love of Ares and Aphrodite? Have you had any thoughts about it? What's that all about? Yes.
Often comes into
I beg your pardon?
Conflict often comes into a marriage.
Yes.
It can't
become
with another
person. No. Right. Right. Very good way of looking at conflict coming into relationship, into marriage or relationship. And Aphrodite does go to bed with it and brings her love power to it. Good way of looking at it. She doesn't battle with Ares. She brings some of the potentiality of love, which seems rather extensive, to say the least. I think as we get into this next part, it does involve my doing a fair amount of reading, but if you can just forget I'm here and hear the story. What? It is? I have to look. Yes, it's on. It's on talk.
If we turn it up,
well, I'm going to pin it more in the middle.
Okay. You can move it up here and see if it
I've moved it this way, but move it some more.
Mm-hmm, okay.
Where you can. It doesn't hurt the rest of the cotton.
Okay.
Oh, now maybe that will. Will that be any better? Mm-hmm. That window isn't open, is it? That
yeah.
Oh, but we need the air, I guess. Mm-hmm. It does make more interior noise than we had before.
Betty, can you close that while you're reading?
Well, that's what I wondered if we could. Could somebody close that maybe during the reading? And maybe we could open that one a little more in the back.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, I have to... Something got stapled wrong. This is the scene, the net scene, and this is from my paper, Aphrodite of the Silver Step, from the group of papers published as, did I say it was, The Well of Living Waters. I think so, The Well of Living Waters. I can't at the moment remember who edited it. I think Rose Emily Rothenberg. I think she was the editor. Hephaestus is has made the net. I won't read you that part. But he's really worried. He knows Aphrodite has taken a lover. He's really worried and he's angry. And he's made the net. And he says something like this. I'm going to edit this as I read. To the forge, this excellent piece of bronze we shall hammer thin into a net, gossamer as the spider's web, and as invisible. Do you understand? He's speaking to the Cyclopes and the Cabiri who help him in the forge. It shall be our noblest work, for nothing is too fine for my Aphrodite. Yet I am enraged with her. By Zeus, my net shall set limits upon her. It is I who shall stop this prodigal lovemaking. She who binds all things together, indeed. In my fierce husband knowledge, I know that it is I who must bind her, for she stretches the boundaries of her bounty beyond belief. And so he plans to capture her. My errant butterfly, you with your sidelong glance, assigned to Ares. You shall think my lacework no more than the morning sunlight streaming upon the bed. Little shall you guess that it is my passion, exquisitely hammered out, that imprisons you. So he makes the net, and he makes the net, he spreads it over the bed, it is almost invisible like a spider web, and Aphrodite, and then he goes off to his forge, and Aphrodite and Ares come, and when they begin to move out of their love embrace, they are caught in the net. And so Hephaestus calls his fellow Olympians, and they all come from Olympus, gods and goddesses alike. And the ones that enter the dialogue are Apollo and Hermes and Hephaestus. But presumably they all came and saw the situation, and here they were exposed. Aphrodite and Ares exposed in the most embarrassing situation, and Hephaestus wanted his vengeance and justice, especially justice. So the gods go away then again, all except Apollo and Hermes, who remain behind with Hephaestus. with a distraught Hephaestus. And Apollo says, let's see, I'll put Apollo on this side when I look this way, and Hermes on this side, and Hephaestus in the middle, if I can remember. Apollo says, what love can bear witnesses, Hephaestus? And Hermes says, love loves courting, but it abhors being brought to court. And Hephaestus says, consider, she has wounded me twice. First it was with love's fierce arrow, from which I shall never recover. And now see how she brings me down, her victim. I am abandoned for this other god-lover. Yet have I been ever tender with her, taking her even now within the transparent bronze lace of my hammered net, as one would take a butterfly that leaves one flower for another. Love that is caught could very soon turn out to be love that is lost, I should say. It was all but invisible, but now I perceive the net, Apollo says. Look, Hermes, I felt at once a different quality than the light that glances off my chariot, but could discern no substance. What a marvel of trickery, Hephaestus. For Aphrodite we see plainly, dressed for her bath, one might say, a revelation that has left all Olympian eyes gaping. And who is this but the handsome Ares? Where was your cleverness, god of war, that you stepped so easily into this ambush? However sweet, have you nothing to say? And Hermes said, he disdains the power of speech, whose path and byways I know well. But he knows the ways of speech. Oh, why could he not have satisfied himself with words? But no, he must have the deed. Yet, Aphrodite brings the fair dialogue to lovers often enough. Look, are you not like Ares, Hephaestus, one who also uses speech sparingly, since your glory is in the accomplished act? Oddly, there we are brothers, Ares and I. But take a closer look at my bronze net, Hermes. Unlike you, I am only a beginner in trickery, remember. An extraordinary work it is. Curiously, it strains out two fish instead of one. Was this your intention, Hephaestus? Naturally, how else capture the thief, since the deed itself can scarcely be strained out? Ah, but which one's the thief? Will you hold both Aphrodite and Ares in this cozy prison while you sort out the matter of guilt? What do you say, Apollo, since you're the expert on law and guilt? Whom should Hephaestus hold answerable to the misdemeanor? Beautiful Aphrodite or fierce Ares? He can take his choice, for neither will pay up in any case. Hold, what kind of answer is this from Delphi's font of wisdom? Will you not even judge the crime? It is clearly a question, Hephaestus says, of which one made the first move, Apollo. Clearly, nothing is clearer in matters of love. Besides, the response of passion can be fully as incriminating as the initial act that evoked it. Ah, it is as I suspected, both are guilty. So I shall spend my anger's vengeance upon the two of them, those squirmers in my net. No matter that Aphrodite would have first given that sidelong glance that fells the god it falls upon. Wait, Apollo said. So it is your wife that you hold responsible. You might have said so. Get that. He's sure the sidelong glance came first. What's this? The invincible god of war was brought down by Aphrodite's look. It is a conquest that the poets will make much of in company of the muses on Parnassus. Apollo, I can hear them now. Something like this. With the charm of Charis that streams from her eyes, Aphrodite captures war himself with love's soft sighs. Is there no compassion for the faithful injured husband? Never mind that Hermes is practicing up to present himself in the next Delian contest, a poet in some disguise or other. I share with you the bitterness of your rejection, Hephaestus. Nevertheless, be consoled that she at least chose a strong, handsome god to replace you. That leaves you a little pride. Consider, will you, that my own case was more grievous. For my beloved Daphne fled from my love, and when I naturally pursued, running close behind the fleet nymph, she exchanged me for a bunch of leaves. For leaves, Daphne rejected the great Apollo? What displaced passion? Aphrodite would have chosen a more lively lover than a tree, I'm sure. Of Cyprian, I'm certain that is so. Yet do I love Daphne, and I wear the laurel leaves with a secret hope that someday she may embrace me for her tree. Hope is a weightless bird, buoyant on the tide of Delphi's air. But where I work, the sun has withdrawn itself. My works are of weighty metal, visible and enduring, their forms beaten out upon the fire. What have I to do with hope? I ask you, would you make your love of Aphrodite as tangible as your other works? Exactly. But you have not judged Aphrodite, Apollo. Such guilt as hers, ask for a reckoning. Can the goddess of sweet bounty be held guilty of the crime of abundance? Besides, Aphrodite sheds guilt easily, I should imagine. Answer me this question, Apollo says. Will you willingly part with Aphrodite? Never. Well, I thought as much. Then some resolution must come swiftly. If I were you, I should not wish to face Ares, released from a net in which he was detained over long. Yet it must be pleasant to have Aphrodite in a bridal net of one's own design. As for Ares, he's the wrong fish to hold. Let him go, Hephaestus. Surely you do not prize the battleground he makes for you here. And so, Hephaestus says, I need to make it a little shorter, that what he wants is justice. And Hermes said, justice is Ares' best ploy. When justice fills love's passion, one is done in at once. Ares need not lift his sword to make a scratch. Hermes is right, you know. Let him go. Besides, he could be dangerous when Aphrodite is no longer taming him. And she's beginning to look bored and a little peeved, I'd say. So without further protest, Hephaestus lifts the bronze net from the bed. Ares leaps out at once, departs, scowling and dragging his armor behind him. Hephaestus cries after him, "Here the doors of hospitality are forever closed to you." With no thought to haste, Aphrodite also stepped forth from the net. Musing as one alone in contemplation, she slowly pulled on her flowing peplos and belted it, and she smoothed her hair, setting thereon a garland of fragrant roses. Sometimes she wears roses. Upon the three gods present, she bestowed no glance of acknowledgement, but picked up her mirror and held it to her face, her back turned to the three gods. An enormous groan escaped Hephaestus. Hermes, wearing an amused expression, was the first to speak. The day presses too soon, perhaps, when the night is wont to linger. And Aphrodite says, "The hour is ungodly." Hermes said, "I, for one, should not have wished to disturb you, Aphrodite, but Hephaestus, your husband, who has been in an abyss of distress, summoned us. Apollo has been pressed to judge, you see." "Greetings, Hermes. You are welcome. But Hephaestus, why have you troubled Apollo?" "To judge the deed. By Paphos, I swear, there was a deed before the deed. Yours." Perhaps you will elaborate, goddess." She was still gazing in her mirror, still with her back to the gods. "Had you not devised your net, you should not have bound me to Ares, Hephaestus. It is a wearisome deed, that of a craftsman who's already made everything else and who is but seized by a novel notion." "You gods be my witnesses," he cries. "What nonsense is this? It was I who bound you in passion to Ares? I do not give you credit for love's passion," she said. "Come, join us a bit, Aphrodite, and explain." She turns now and approaches him. "Explanation is your labor, Apollo, yet telling is within my grasp. Ares has long been enamored of me, yet it was the net of Hephaestus that brought us together and hardened this love within the day mind where it sticks fast." "What's this?" "Yes? Something different you are saying to us, goddess, although I must strain rarely used ears to hear it. The day mind now holds this love, you say. It was never meant for the day mind, Hermes, this love between Ares and myself, for what is nocturnal is not for the light of day. Hephaestus, you have seized the tender life of dream, playing in its own secluded time, and poured upon it the dreadful mortar of the day's fact." Oh, woe, can I believe her? "By day, dear spouse, I have only distaste for Ares, for he's all metal and has no conversation, and his sense of humor is as clanging as his armor." "Hear me, Hephaestus. With your net, you have mixed two worlds. Zeus, help me, who gave me this one for a wife." "It is true, Apollo, that she knows the nocturnal world, even the landscape of the lower realm. perhaps I've never told you, but it was Aphrodite who gave me the flower of the pomegranate. And Aphrodite says, the error that Hephaestus has committed, Hermes may judge, for he moves between the world, the two worlds with knowledgeable grace. Do you intend then to bring Hephaestus to trial? If so, may I suggest that Delphi is not the place for it. I do not care for law and judgment, Apollo. For are not such boundaries a tedium of the minds of God and men? Judgment pairs thin all possibility, shepherding our acts like sheep upon a narrow path. Yet not content with this treachery, it binds the mind that begets first things and first times. Nevertheless, some boundaries I guard, Aphrodite, for gods and men alike. The categories of understanding are mine. Let the boundaries remain yours, Apollo. As for me, I know no boundaries. A fact already well observed. Then Hephaestus shall not be judged for the making of the net? No, never. Will Hephaestus give up Aphrodite? Never. Now, this is Hermes quoting. Will Hephaestus give up Aphrodite? Never. Will Aphrodite bring Hephaestus to judgment? Never. Are these two nevers strangely equal to one forever? For forever is the nature of immortal love, so sought after by mortals, but with rare success. Delphi, we worship Aphrodite as she who binds all things together, while at Thebes she is said to turn hearts away as often as she turns hearts to love. Surely the Thebans are not dull in understanding, for the heart that loves has within its single beat possession, loss, possession, so that its very ecstasy holds dialogue with emptiness. That's Apollo speaking. If the heart is hollow that waits for Aphrodite's bounty, surely it were not wise to parcel out her gift of love in accordance with our own parsimony. What do you say, Hephaestus? I say that henceforth I shall delegate all matters of the heart to Aphrodite. Only one condition I put upon you, beloved goddess. And what would that condition be, she asked. I ask that you never be far from my hands. For life pours forth not from my words, nor from the image my body casts before others' eyes. Nor does it flow from valorous deeds. I am Hephaestus, whose spirit awakens and moves in his hands. Oh, stay near me, Aphrodite, in body entire, not evaporated into idea or distant image. For what I know through its living body, through the feel of the substance in my hands. And dearest of all tangible things to me is your presence. It is a simple thing you ask of me, for I was never of idea made, dear Hephaestus. Wherever I step, there I am, body and all. One thing more I would urge you to remember, I am goddess of love, not of consequences. And Apollo says, that leaves the 11 of us to sort out those, I presume. Still, I long to see the earth flower again under your silver step. Ah, And will you again fetch me the pomegranate flower? The best things bear repeating, Aphrodite. So that's the end of the scene with the net.
Can I ask one? Mm-hmm. You know, justice kills passion.
Okay. What of justice? Is it not mine? Justice is Ares' best ploy, Hermes says. When justice fills love's passion, one is at once done in. Ares need not lift his sword to make a scratch. That might be just a good place to start with the... because this has been the cry of Hephaestus in his hurt and suffering, was the cry of justice. And who said that now? Who did I say said that? Hermes? Hermes. And that's when the conversation that follows has to do with letting Ares go. And the notion that they've caught the wrong fish. And that it's really Aphrodite he wants to save for himself. So do you feel a shift then when Ares goes? Do you feel a shift in what the net is doing? I don't know. It's not written analytically, you understand. It's just written with the story. And but I think this is something to spend a little bit of time with us, see if we could... That's a good question. What does he have in the net? What is in Hephaestus' net in the beginning of this tale, in the beginning of this part of the tale? And from Hephaestus' point of view, what has he got? Enemies, lovers, but he's got the culprit.
At one point, he's got the culprit.
He's got the culprit, uh-huh. And then, of course, Hermes and Apollo raise the question, which one is it?
But he thinks he has the culprit.
He thinks he has a culprit. In fact, he finally says probably both are guilty. So where does that put the relationship to this new event in Hephaestus' experience? It's a new love that's entered his household. If the whole household is the Psyche, see, not just talking about a marriage here, but if the whole household is the Psyche, and here there's a new love and a new dynamic that's entered the household. Yes.
But you can see that by shaming them, you can control love. Greater, it enlarges you. And when you're really in small closets, it makes you smaller.
To a larger process, really. And of course, there is a very strong, strong feeling of transgression here, isn't there? Certainly would have been for the Greeks. Would have been, there is in the whole myth a sense, and for the Olympians, there's a strong sense of transgression here, which takes us to myths, even like Adam and Eve in the garden, Eve and the serpent, and so forth. The notion of transgression, which often precedes a new opening of the way of the self, before there's any credential for it or any credibility for it given to it. Yes.
Cannot punish that specific instance of love without punishing all love. There's no way to separate them out because it's all love.
Right.
You can't take.
Good point.
If he tries to take this specific instance of that relationship, he will then cast his net over all.
Right. Including a pall over the whole thing. Very good point. Very good point. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
I'm not sure how to ask that. But I had an earlier thought about.
And I've thought that that's kind of a powerful image in mythology. It occurs with Perseus, the baby Perseus, when he and his mother are abandoned in the sea, and a fisherman on the island of Seriphos takes them up in a net. And it seemed to be a very intriguing thing to net something out of the depths. So I wonder if that kind of in the background here too, a net is part of the sea world usually. It's not usually fine bronze, but it's part of the sea world, and Aphrodite is so close to the sea that that it has something to do with bringing things up from the unconscious, or from the depths, or from the source place.
What do you think was behind the fact that after he just did it, that he had all the other organs coming to see?
Well, what do you think?
I don't know, but one of the versions that I remember reading they were all kind of laughing, joking about the embarrassing situation, and Hermes, you know, when he said, well, he'd be willing to undergo the experience just to be in bed with Aphrodite.
Yeah. Right.
It was they didn't deal much with, at least I don't remember wherever I read it, that it dealt with Hephaestus' need to, he was really trying to throw some sort of emotion in himself. I don't know, but this would be an entryway, what would have just been a transgression?
And can it simply be that he feels quite helpless to keep this powerful goddess, his wife, and so naturally calls on all the gods? Then there's that other aspect of, wanting to be the justified husband, the righteous husband.
Mm-hmm.
But the great loves, like the great weddings of the gods, usually call for all the gods to come. So that's often true of these important bonds. The marriage of Thetis and what's his name? Peleus. Some of these important, the marriage of Psyche and Eros, and a number of important weddings in mythology call for the gods to all come, which really adds a tremendous blessing. So this is certainly a marriage that he feels he wants to have continue. He needs the blessing of the gods on it, too. Yes. Yes. Well, we don't really know, at what point it. For all intents and purposes, this is the end of it. I think in terms of myth, it's the end of it. But we do know that it was a kind of a long courtship. So.
And it's been going on for some time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Right. And Aphrodite claims it belongs to what realm? Uh-huh. That it's like the dream reality. And that he should know better than to mix the two realities. Or something.
Backing up just a little bit, so I was thinking about the idea of holding the box.
Mm-hmm.
But he also has to let Ares go. It's like the warrior has to leave before he shows Rudra. And it's not to judge, mm-hmm. because to judge it, then neither would really win mm-hmm. in that. So the conflict has to go and what remains. Mm-hmm. And so yeah. Once you've caught it and seen it for what it is, yeah. and seen the different sides of who's at fault or not, Ares or Aphrodite, and then later Aphrodite or Thetis himself, there's a letting go of the conflict aspect so that you still have the original relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, now this is all from the standpoint of Hephaestus here. What do you suppose has happened to Ares? Has he gotten any benefit out of this? No, it isn't. Uh-huh. Right. What?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It's almost like you didn't get it, Especially you've shown the light on the truth, and that mm-hmm. was one truth, and then Aphrodite spoke of the other truth,
mm-hmm.
and he just sort of stormed off like a big bumbling lawyer. Mm-hmm. It sort of feels yep. like he didn't get it.
Yeah, yeah.
I would imagine he felt humiliated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This makes me wonder where love is in war.
Mm-hmm.
The aspect of the warrior and loving the work, loving the killing.
Yes.
Yes.
It's that side.
It's one of the few ways the males can express their bond is when they're under fire.
Mm-hmm.
They kill together.
Mm-hmm.
In
mm-hmm.
sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the picture of the day when I feel not lonely
yes.
on that ship in the world and start to yes. Aphrodite
between them. Yes, it is.
In a way there's no other experience for
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because it gets so deep into the instinctual nature. The war pulls out so much. Yeah. Yes. Yes, I think that's very important to see. Mm-hmm. And I think it is an important line in Ares where he says, we too are the guts of the cosmos, or something like that. That we're the two important forces in the cosmos. And of course the Greek philosopher Heraclitus did a great deal with conflict and attraction. I think, did he call it love? I can't recall. Love and conflict. As the two great forces in the universe, having to do with astronomy and physics and everything, biology and... so you have this, yes.
This is somewhat new to me. I wondered if the gods and goddesses are bound by their qualities. You know, those qualities that they have and that...
Yeah. I think that's a good question. Are gods and goddesses bound by the qualities they have? Well, they dwell in the qualities that they have. It particularizes a god or goddess, because after all, it comes out of the collective psyche, the sense of the particularity. So Hermes raises that question. Can you expect a goddess of bounty to quit being abundant? You know, that it is her nature to love, to give love where it's needed, to continue to love. And that seems to be the nature of Aphrodite. This is particularly expressed in the worship at only one place on mainland Greece, which was in ancient Corinth, on the Acrocorinth, that great rock mountain that rises above the city of Corinth, where her temple stood. And there was where she was served by the temple courtesans. And I think Esther Harding's description of this, of the courtesans of Aphrodite and the love goddesses, is a very strong and supportive one. They're not just loose women. They are women serving the goddess, not serving men, but serving the goddess, and are bountiful and give the love to the worshiper of Aphrodite who comes. The male worshiper who comes. So it's tricky for us with our present views of what that would mean to get the old sense of that. But it has to do with her bounty, and there they it was very disturbing to the Apostle Paul. But speaking of the Apostle Paul, I've enjoyed going back and thinking over Paul quite a few times. He wrote the Corinthians more than any other Christian church. He went to Corinth more repeatedly. I forget how many trips he made there. I mean, after all, there was Ephesus and Galatia and many other places. He kept running back and forth to Corinth. Now, I'm not for the moment in any way suggesting that he took part with the courtesans. That would be too far out for this strong Judaic Christian. And but he wrote his great chapter on love to the Corinthians after he'd one of his trips. And it's a really inspired, you know, beautiful essay on love. And there's something, and I later came to feel, well, you know, I think Aphrodite had her influence at a distance on him. And then there's something else. He wrote the Corinthians, or wrote from Corinth to some group. You may know where it is better than I do, where he's telling people the early Christians would go to somebody's house for dinner, and they would say, before they partook of the meat, they weren't vegetarians, before they partook of the meat, they'd say, how was this meat secured? Was it dedicated to any pagan god or goddess? See, because you could eat the sacrifices, you know. And if it was had been offered to a god or goddess, pagan god or goddess, then they refused to partake of it. And this is understandable. Do you know that Paul told them to quit that? And it was rather shortly after this long trip to Corinth, and I thought, well, that's Aphrodite's influence too, because he says such things, this is rather heretical, you understand, nobody supports this viewpoint, but he said, you should be more gracious. Somebody has you to their house for dinner, don't ask where they got the meat, just eat it and enjoy. It's important to be gracious if you are a follower of Christ. It's important to be gracious. I thought, gracious, that's Aphrodite, gracious. So I felt somewhere he was touched by Corinth, and he was very concerned about the practice of the courtesans. He regarded that simply as sin, but he was touched by something with Aphrodite, I think.
And it seemed like in war that people or men fighting together are together in the moment. I mean, when you're in battle, specifically, you don't think of consequences so much, or of the future or the past. It's very intense and immediate in the moment. And then later, when she leaves the net, when she says to the professor that he makes it to know, he made every moment into a future and a past, which wasn't the realm of the area that he loved. I mean, it was just an intense immediate moment, which is what Aphrodite is here. Whereas her role as Hephaestus is white, and Hephaestus said to her, be with me always, be in my hand always. Which is more a future
in
the past than always.
Mm-hmm.
It's a longer term thing.
Yes.
Whereas
air gives me the. Yes. Yes, and I wonder if there isn't a need for Aphrodite through maybe Apollo's help, he's a great god of form and structure, to make a new container for, and especially speaking of this as the house of Psyche, the house of the Psyche, that there needs to be a new container, not the bed with Hephaestus, but a new container place for this new love that comes in. And once again, I'm not taking it on the outside or talking about trying to live with in two loves at once. I'm just talking about it from the standpoint of the psyche. And the natural thing to do is to want to harmonize it with the marriage or with the existing relationship, with the status quo. That's what Hephaestus is trying to do. And it doesn't harmonize there. It has to have a different place. And I think that we do that when we have a new creative interest or spiritual path, and we come to the person we love and want them to understand it and hear it all right now, hear all about it and understand it, accept it and understand it, and almost to have our experience with us. And that's kind of it needs to stay in the nocturnal realm, the realm of one's solitude or one special place for that new fertilizing from the gods, new fertilizing aspect from the gods. Yes.
There's quite a difference between the containment of Phaistos' metal net and Apollo's.
Yes, there is a difference in that containment. It's much freer, you feel, with Apollo. And of course, Apollo goes, has his access to the muses. So it goes into song and all the beautiful forms of music and art, and which is, means any of the soul's expression, you know. Goes into, yeah. So he's a very helpful god in that respect.
I'd like to go back one step, Betty. I'm in the midst of a great passion, and I tried recently to share it with my two children, and it was very heartily and soundly rebuffed, and very wounded.
Uh-huh.
And so my question is, and it may be very naive, is if you cannot share all of this with those that you love the most, what do you do with it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm just, I'm bursting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my container is ready to spill over. I see I'm going to explode.
Mm-hmm.
But those I love the most have not chosen to be the least interested. So, you know, I'm wondering where I am.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, what do you say to that?
That's what friends are for.
That's what friends are for. There's an answer. That's what friends are for, not family.
But I find that with so many of my friends, none of them are, they're wonderful friends, but they're not aware, quote-unquote, of anything having to do with Jungian psychology or any of what's really going on with me. And I find it very difficult to try to explain the basics to them so they know where I'm even coming from. It's very frustrating.
Yes, I appreciate that. Yes.
I look at that, I think about that part where it says in the D-mind where it sticks fast. It's like somehow it's not ready to come into the D-mind. It feels like it needs to stay in that nocturnal realm.
Yeah.
And the image, what tags onto that for me is the image of how Aries seems disempowered as he leaves. He's the god of war. He's figure, and in that nocturnal place, he is powerful. But when he's exposed and stuck fast, he's disempowered, and it's, he feels awful. You know, for me, awful. So that somehow speaks to me.
Randy, what were you going to say? Thank you, Lynn.
My reaction to that is to think that that's where Mars is needed, since his quality is boldness.
Mm-hmm.
Not getting the recognition from concerning your love, you're not getting recognition. That doesn't say anything about what you should do to an actor. And you should still do it.
Right.
You know, be bold with what it is you want to do.
I see.
Maybe in your actions, your loved ones can see that you're a serious about it, and just count about it.
Yes. 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 Good point.
It was Aphrodite, the way she dealt with the whole thing. There was a kind of a delicacy and wasn't really a flag on the glass, but using the mirror. I mean, she really she almost dealt with it by not being anything. She didn't use the heavy hand. She just she was there.
Mm-hmm.
With the whole thing. And she wasn't
part of anything. No, she wasn't.
And, so there was something about the elegance in that situation.
Even though what she says is definitely in the kind of non-rational way that she's supposed to. Yes.
When she said casting the net over.
Casting the net over.
I forget the name.
You did the deed before the deed.
Yeah, when we were bound. You caused us then to be bound.
Yes.
Before them.
Yes.
And I don't know exactly what she means by that, but I think of that somehow my sense is that her husband somehow was trying to capture this something that was here. I mean, if you knew that they needed something that this new love could bring into their present relationship and yet by that very act and trying to continue, he in fact killed it.
I do think in bringing it to a very practical ground, apropos to that, everyday ground of dealing with one's dreams, dealing with active imagination, if you try to put it in the language of the day or translate it into an idiom that's really general or allowed to be understood, you can very quickly lose the individuality and uniqueness of what the speech of the dream was to oneself or the other. It's very important about containing one's process. That's important. So in a sense, although Hephaestus wanted to recapture Aphrodite, perhaps with the new infusion, who knows, but he wanted to recapture her, nevertheless, he over-contains and he has to learn something about how to use his net. And I think this is very important, how we use the net with the unconscious and it's it does require a fair amount of solitude, I think. A solitary situation in dealing with one's net with the unconscious or with the gods. And seeing what one brings up for oneself and not asking that it immediately be translated into one's existing covenants or jobs or talents or the kind of immediate translation that Hephaestus was demanding here. He's a very tangible guy, Hephaestus. He's got to have the substance in his hands. But a great creator. God. I have a lot of respect for him. Incidentally, he and Athena were really the natural pair of man-woman companions. And in Athens, they have a great affinity for each other. Athena and Hephaestus are both great worker gods. But that's neither here nor there at the moment, but I think he was enriched by his relationship to Aphrodite. It's not conveyed in a sexual manner, but it's Athena's image that is honored in the temple of Hephaestus.
I was just mentioning that Hephaestus' need for Aphrodite. I was having trouble trying to get a sense of why she needed him.
Why she needs him?
Yeah. It seems, when you look at it on the surface, it seems kind of one way. I mean, she's so wonderful and all the gods and her and everybody desires her.
Yes.
And yet she's obviously into this relationship also on a long-term basis. And what does she need? And the only thing I could come up with the hands. At the end, he lives through his hands.
Yes.
And she is the woman that he needs.
All right.
And so I thought, here we're back to the compensatory part of the relationship.
And it seems to me he grounds her in a new way. You know, she's an earth goddess grounded in feeling and sense and instinct, but not in those enduring things that pass into life. Yes, All right, back here.
It was mentioned earlier that the god of war, Ares, and the love of war, would be actually a component of Aphrodite. And I'm wondering, since Aphrodite was attracted to Ares, where is the godlike qualities in Aphrodite, hence the attraction?
Now wait a minute. Since, say that just again. Say it again. Okay.
It was mentioned earlier that Ares had a love of war.
Yes.
Love is a quality of Aphrodite.
Yes.
Aphrodite is attracted to Ares.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, where is the warlike qualities of Aphrodite and
oh.
the attraction? I mean, it's not clear in that myth, but this is a question. But maybe it's a digression at this point.
No.
Rejection.
Mm-hmm. The fierceness of passion.
The what?
The fierceness of passion.
Mm-hmm. Fierceness of passion. Mm-hmm. There is this bold nature to love, you know, too. Bold, pouncing quality that she talked about feeling in Aries. And there is some affinity between love and conflict. As you said, between love and war, the actual outer historical facts of war. And but there's also there's certainly opposites that attract, but that would mean it was less developed in her, and therefore she's attracted to it in him. And the love, which is not well developed in Aries, he finds in her. I mean the many of the qualities of love he finds in her. Interesting. I mean, it's really... I don't pretend to understand that. I keep coming at these myths again and again, and...
I think of the parallel between Paul and Greek, the Corinthians, when
mm-hmm.
you say that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Finding the forbidden.
Yes. Right. Well, it just... I felt it seeped into the Apostle Paul in a rather good way. It's time for us to take a break. Just let me read a very few statements. The net one needs, I think, is a way of capturing the opposite pulls in one's life, to hold them together long enough for a conscious process to take place. Okay, the net one needs, it must be able to capture the opposite pulls, the opposites. Whatever the opposites are that are pulling upon you. And hold them together for some conscious process for some time. It must contain them well so one does not lose the one or the other. It must contain them lightly so that there's no dark prison aspect to it. It has to be sturdy and strong. And this net must be invisible so that the inner world alone can see it. No public witnesses or exposure. Now you say, well, it was public in this myth. No, it wasn't. It was the gods who saw it. No, the gods can look in on your net, and they better.
And they do.
And they do. What did Jung say? Called or not called? Yes, but also, yeah, bidden or not bidden, called or not called, God is there. And the net must draw the gods to the conscious process. Now, alternatives, and this is really it for the break, but alternatives to having a good net, like Hephaestus's, is get rid of the opposition. I mean, don't try to hold on to it at all. Don't give it a place at all. one individual in a relationship has a desire to pursue a certain new activity or interest, and it creates a lot of tension or a lot of conflict, and so, you know, one throws out the desire or the new interest, or the one says we can't tolerate it. So that's not developing the net that can hold the opposites. Keeping things status quo, keeping the boat from rocking at all, or keeping the status quo, is an alternative to having a good net. And then this last statement, keeping too narrow an image of love's process in us is an opposition to the net. Too narrow an image of how this process of psyche should work, which love is. Love amplifies itself in ways often unanticipated. It puts seeds upon the wind into the spirit. Much more is fertilized, is given a chance, than just feelings. And I would like to emphasize that, that love is very much more than just feelings and pleasure. And it is truly an organic fertilizing process in which, as extensive as going from grapes to wine, as extensive as going from seed to the harvested crop. I mean, it's that kind of organic process. So the net is an assistant and a help, holding things lightly available and holding them there for a conscious process, but probably not ready to be shared yet. There's one short final scene to that myth when we get back. Not a part of that paper, but... Before you leave, I want to tell everybody how Aphrodite was healed. I'm not going to read it to you from the Iliad, but you can read it in Book 5, starting with line 330. And she is healed by Dione. Dione binds up her hand, and Dione tells her, as she binds her hand, her mother, Dione, the oracular goddess, tells her about all the wounds that other people, other gods, have suffered. The various woundings of gods and heroes. I think she also mentions heroes. As if to say, you know, take your place among the wounded. You're not the only one, you know, even though you're my only daughter. And so I feel like it's a process of memory in the deep sense of mnemosyne, which is a very, very important creative source of all the creative life, is mnemosyne, memory. And she is the mother of the Muses. And when Hermes is first born, he sings a hymn. Or as soon as he makes the lyre, when he's just still an infant, he sings his first song to mnemosyne, and as the great source, deep, like the deep well of human being and human existence. So mnemosyne, I'll tell you how to spell it later, M-N, it begins. So she is healed, and Apollo, who's certainly a helpful god here, Apollo was a healer god. We always hear such narrow things about Apollo today, as if he were a straight-laced god of reason. He was the god of the Muses, very close to the Muses, music, song, poetry, But he also is a great healer of gods. And that's his aspect as peon, Apollo. The song, the holy song that is sung to him is called a peon, with an A-N. Hmm? How do you say that? No, you don't say it that way. Peon? Peon. That's right, peon. But that comes from peon, P-A-E-O-N, peon, in Greek, meaning the great healer Apollo. I don't know that it means that, but that's what it came to refer to. I don't know the derivation of the word. So he has picked up Aeneas, the wounded Aeneas, and he carries him to his temple at Pergamum in Turkey. Well, it wasn't Turkey then, it was a Greek colony. The great city of Pergamum. And there in his temple, he turns Aeneas over to his mother Leto and his sister Artemis. And together they work over Aeneas and bind his hip and are able to heal Aeneas. So later, when the walls of Troy fall and Aeneas is well again, and it is he who goes out from burning Troy carrying his father Anchises on his shoulders, his ancient father, the Anchises who was loved by Aphrodite. And they go to settle a new place. It takes the place of the gods. It takes the feminine to heal the feminine, apparently, here. The great feminine source goddess to heal, and also the wise goddess to heal Aphrodite, so that she can again have a giving hand and a holding hand to sustain things. This is just the last last scene of the Aphrodite and Ares love story. Apollo and Hermes have lingered in the house of Hephaestus and Aphrodite after Ares has left. The face of Hephaestus is played over by many emotions, each one gripping him. Everything from relief to anger to his love for Aphrodite, his being annoyed with her, his gratitude towards Apollo and Hermes, and so forth. It is now Hermes who goes aside and walks with Aphrodite. And there's no myth exactly for this scene. It's just a conversation that arises out of it. Hermes said, "The end of such love comes swiftly, yet the recovery takes longer." "Ah, yes," she said, "it is like a fragile vase one shatters quite unexpectedly. And how can it ever be mended?" Now, this is treating it as the end of this love experience. Now's the time of integration, beginning of integration. "How can it ever be mended?" she said. "I appreciate your distress," Hermes says, "but speak to me of this love." "It is Ares I must speak of," she said. "Something about him captured me. He is so unwoman." Hermes smiled at this. That boldness, how is it to be described? With burning eyes fixed on his goal, he charges ahead, indifferent to every consideration, every distraction. He is totally engaged, as in a battle, it seems. And was it such a battle? "I am not easily won, Hermes." "Of course not." He smiled his dazzling smile. "Such a carelessness is in his manner of where he steps," she said. "Such a carelessness is in his manner of where he steps." There was certainly that. At first I was angered by this, but then it vanquished me, one could say. Bold steps and winning, I should say that these are not unwoman, as you put it. They are not unwoman, he said. Actually, they become yours, Aphrodite, in the way of love. In a way, it would seem that you and Ares have long been companions. Only your areas of action are very different. He's the boldness and the mad plunge when you have just appeared on the human scene. In that first moment with Aphrodite, is not every other scene of one's life curtained off as though it did not exist? Yes, I should say that Ares is always present in the onset of love. I, for one, have always found him a bit mad. Aphrodite looked a little peeved at that. You make love sound like a declaration of war, Hermes. In its onset, it is at least that, is it not? Two worlds meet as two persons. It is a meeting of utter strangers, each trailing a far country's allure. But Ares and I had not been strangers before we were lovers, surely. He is as much a part of the Olympian circle of gods as you or I. We were friends first. True. But when Eros's arrows fall, two friends become utter strangers, each an envoy of a never-before-known country. Only strangers are plunged into the small god's mad enchantment, you see. It is over strangers that love spreads its net and brings about its pleasant seizure. It is these who strangers who then become lovers? He nodded. One only loves what one is not, of course. One only loves what one is not, of course. One only comes to love what one has never known before. Desire, my constant companion, appears ever to draw us to an untouched island shore. Ah, Hermes, this land that is touched for the first time is well known to me as goddess of love. It is the land of one's innocence. Yes, that is love's saving grace. A lover stands whole in what he is, with nothing bent or groveling or exhausted in himself. His is the recovered innocence of childhood. Let us not speak of this anymore. Ares is gone, and I am again joined with Hephaestus. Ares has left me his boldness, you say. The gift I have made him is the recovery of his innocent self. Perhaps I have even sabotaged for a time his capacity to do battle. Did you see how sheepishly he dragged his armor behind him when he left this house? For a time, you have gentled the battle god, I should say. So that's, I think that's the end.
Nothing groveling, something else?
Oh, nothing groveling, nothing. Nothing exhausted.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.